Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There was another big document dropped today, and this time WikiLeaks did not do it. The Federal Reserve released a trove of information about all those emergency loans it made during the financial meltdown 2 years ago. All the details of who got what and when. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Toyota. Toyota is sharing technology and ideas for a better world. Learn more at toyota.com/ideas for good. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Wednesday. It is the first day of December. One of the great unsolved mysteries of the financial crisis of 2008 was which banks got how much bailout money, why, and when. Not going to tell you, said the Fed at the time, and the banks weren't talking either. We got the broad outlines, but the details remained hidden, in part to prevent people from taking all their money out of the banks that were teetering on the verge of insolvency. It was all a big secret until today. As required by the Financial Reform Act known as Dodd-Frank, the document dump reveals 21,000 transactions worth trillions of dollars. Marketplace's David Gura reports from Washington that all this just adds fuel to the debate over why the Fed did what it did.
The Federal Reserve named names. The cast of characters is familiar. Citigroup, Bear Stearns, Goldman Sachs, AIG. The list goes on. A handful of foreign banks got loans too, including Barclays and RBS. We found out how much they borrowed, and it was a lot. The Fed doled out $9 trillion in short-term loans to 18 different institutions. I called Marvin Goodfriend, an economist at Carnegie Mellon, and I asked, what's the first thing you're going to do when you download all this data?
There are thousands of transactions here, so I don't know I'm going to do this, but I'm eager to read the summaries to see the extent to which the Federal Reserve protected taxpayers against fiscal losses.
Goodfriend wants to know whether loaning out that much money so fast meant the Fed was gambling with our tax dollars.
The obligation of an independent central bank is to make sure that it protects taxpayers against losses in doing so.
Roberto Perley is with International Strategy and Investment. He says he doesn't think the Fed took excessive risk, especially because it demanded so much collateral.
The vast majority of loans were way over-collateralized, which tells me the Fed did not take inordinate credit risk here.
Historically, the Fed doesn't release data like this, but the Dodd-Frank Act forced them to. Doug Elliott is an economist at the Brookings Institution. He says from now on, handouts to banks will have to be transparent.
If things improve, as I hope they will, we're not going to care all that much. It's in the heart of a crisis that you actually worry about what's going on.
In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
First, it was yes. Last spring, the White House blessed a dramatic expansion of offshore oil and gas drilling. Now, it's no. Today, the White House reversed itself. It is banning any new drilling on the eastern Gulf of Mexico and along much of the Atlantic coast. Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
The administration will uphold a longtime ban on drilling along the mid and southern Atlantic coast and the west coast of Florida. Ana Aurelio at Environment America says the White House learned a lesson 8 months ago.
The BP disaster earlier this year was unfortunately a really tragic reminder that drilling is a dirty and dangerous business.
In a phone call with reporters this afternoon, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar said the drilling ban would remain until at least 2017. In the meantime, he said, the feds will work up stricter rules and regulations for the offshore industry. Industry officials weren't happy with today's decision. Randall Luthy is president of the National Ocean Industries Association. He says the government and industry could quickly have new safety standards in place, and it's a mistake to effectively stop new exploration.
If we keep staying, you know, in the same parameters in the same area that we're in without expanding, it appears that we're only going to increase our dependence on foreign oil.
But Secretary Salazar suggested today there's still plenty of offshore waters to explore in the Gulf of Mexico. He noted that oil companies have nearly 29 million acres under lease in the Gulf they haven't developed yet.
So there's plenty of opportunity for oil and gas companies to go out and develop these additional resources.
The government predicted three more years of oil might have come from the areas the feds put off limits today. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
As of today, money has run out for federal jobless benefits. That's money that goes to unemployed people when their state benefits run out, and they last up to 99 weeks. In every recent recession, Congress ponied up the money to fund these long-term unemployment checks. But so far, members of Congress have not come up with a deal to pay the $55 billion tab for another extension. That means millions will stop getting those benefits. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more on what that means for the economy and the people who count on that money for their survival.
If ever there were a confusing federal program, this is it. There are four tiers of unemployment benefits based on how long someone's been out of work. And Maurice Emsalem of the National Employment Law Project says no one can add more time.
You collect your 20 weeks, you can't move up to tier 2, 3, and 4.
You can't move up because the federal cupboard is bare. But that doesn't mean all 5 million recipients stop getting checks today. Instead, they run out over the next few months.
There would be a significant hit in the near term. It would grow cumulatively over time.
That's Henry Aaron of the Brookings Institution, and he's one of many prominent economists who have called for another year of funding, even if it adds to the deficit. Aaron says the benefits significantly boost the economy because the money's spent right away for food, gas, and rent.
With the reduction in spending by those who would lose their unemployment benefits, other people will lose jobs. You drop a long way, and then you continue on down.
That downward spiral is about to get personal for Denise Maunder of Atlanta. Her checks run out in February. After 18 months on unemployment, she doesn't buy anything but necessities.
I've got it already pretty close to the bone. If I lose my unemployment, there's a risk of losing my car. And your car is what you need to get work.
If Congress does renew unemployment funding, it's expected to be retroactive to today. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The Santa Claus rally got an early start today, weeks early. The Dow ended December 1st with its biggest gain since September 1st. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Today, the Federal Trade Commission released a report on privacy in the information age, and its chairman was blunt. He said industry self-regulation is not working for American consumers, and many of the companies we entrust with our data are letting us down. Our own Steve Henn has been following the story and joins us now from Silicon Valley. Hi, Steve.
Hey.
So give us a little picture of what the FTC is proposing at this point.
Well, what the FTC really wants is to put consumers back in control of their own information. So here's how John Leibowitz, the chairman of the FTC, described what is going on online right now.
Imagine you're walking through a shopping mall and there's someone standing behind you. And they don't know exactly your name, but they sort of know around where you live or your zip code. And, you know, everywhere you're going, they're sending, like, emails to the stores in front of you saying, you know, that's Leibowitz. He's looking for a mattress jacket and a matching fur coat. And you know, if it's someone behind you, you'd be kind of disturbed by it. And if that person's following your daughter, you want to punch him out.
Wow. Yeah. You can't disagree.
Yeah, well, so the FTC is proposing a kind of national do not track mechanism. It's not really a list, but what they have in mind is a button on your browser that you could push, and that would tell companies, all companies following you around online, basically to leave you alone. And they also want big data aggregators, the companies that store and compile all this information about you, to give customers access to the data about them.
Interesting. You know, I have to say, couldn't you just do this by disabling cookies, or is that not enough anymore?
Well, yeah, you can do it by disabling your cookies, or many browsers have these incognito modes that conceal your identity.
Yeah.
But I think what the FTC wants is for people to have the ability to really control their online experience. You know, if you disable your cookies, you go to a site that you have a relationship with, they don't know who you are.
Does the proposal have teeth?
Well, honestly, at this point, not really, or at least not yet. The FTC was completely upfront about saying that they don't have the authority right now to issue the rules they feel need to be written on this. But there is a pretty vigorous debate brewing in Congress now on privacy, and there seems to be bipartisan support building for some kind of privacy legislation. And Leibovitz also really encouraged the tech industry to get out in front of this and to create a do-not-track mechanism on its own, basically not wait for Congress.
What are the chances of that, do you think?
Well, I think the chances of tech firms trying to do something on their own is actually pretty good. And I think the reason for that is that they really, really don't like the idea of a legislative fix for this problem. So already you're seeing big organizations in online advertising getting together and trying to create some kind of do-not-track-like system that they can live with. You know, for big online advertising businesses, tracking is their business.
Right.
It's central to what they do. And a law that wasn't crafted just the way they like could really kill them.
Let me ask you, though, Steve. You know, this is targeted at people who don't want to be followed around by technology. But it seems like these days, so many people are inviting that. I mean, people are telling the world where they're eating dinner.
Yeah, that's true. And the industry has to take a lot of solace in that. And I think what the FTC really wants is for the industry to be completely transparent about when they're collecting information and how that information is going to be used. If that's true, I don't think the Federal Trade Commission really has a problem with that.
Marketplace's Steve Henn, thanks so much.
Sure thing.
The Presidential Commission, charged with figuring out how to reduce the federal deficit, met again today. Members are still revising the plan before a final vote on Friday. Proposals include raising the Social Security retirement age, cutting the budget for Medicare, and raising some taxes. Commentator Robert Reich says the economy is not ready for that kind of austerity.
For America to worry about the budget deficit right now is like someone who's starving worrying about weight control. Right now, when consumers can't and won't spend, we need more federal spending to make up for the shortfall in demand. Otherwise, we're going to suffer near double-digit unemployment for years. Yes, the projected deficit will be a problem eventually, so it is wise to take steps so we don't go broke in the future. But the President's Deficit Commission is all over the map. Let's be clear about what that long-term problem really is. It's not Social Security. Social Security's only problem is so much of the nation's total income has gone to top earners in recent years that the Social Security tax covers a smaller percentage of total income than was planned for. The obvious answer is to lift the cap on income subject to the Social Security tax to about $150,000. The biggest problem is what lies behind Medicare, the explosive growth in medical costs combined with aging baby boomers. Over the next three decades, drug costs are projected to soar, as well as new medical equipment, diagnostic tests, and complex procedures. The answer is to finish the job of reforming health care. Let Medicare use its bargaining leverage to get low-cost drugs and supplies. End health insurers' immunity from antitrust laws. Allow the public to buy health insurance from a Medicare-like public option. And award plans that focus on disease prevention rather than expensive diagnostics and procedures. Finally, in our zest to cut the budget deficit, let's not shoot ourselves in the feet. We should be spending more, not less, on education, infrastructure, and basic research. These are critical to our future economic growth. Without adequate growth, the deficit will become an even larger share of the total economy. And then we'd really be in trouble.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. His latest book is Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Next Wednesday, commentator David Frum will be here. In the meantime, send us your comments at marketplace.org. Coming up, before low-carbon electricity can be a main source of energy, we need to answer one big question.
can we build environmentally friendly generation that can compete in the marketplace?
But first, let's do the numbers. Happy music indeed. Good economic news here and overseas made for a bonanza today on Wall Street. The Dow packed on 2.25%, 249 points to close at 11,255. The Nasdaq bounced 2%, 51 points to finish at 2549. And the S&P 500 pocketed 2.1%, 25 points to end the day at 1206. Panic over Europe's debt crisis eased and financial shares soared. Bank of America pulled in more than 3%. Citigroup was good for an extra 2.3%. J.P. Morgan Chase deposited 2%, and Goldman Sachs gained about 1.5%. Strong numbers for hiring and manufacturing helped Home Depot nail a 4.5% gain. Caterpillar and Alcoa were both up more than 3.3%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.97%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. By Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at AllyBank.com. And by the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt. It's more car than electric. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The National Association of Realtors reports on pending home sales for the month of October. Did all of that Black Friday hoopla pay off? Major retailers release sales figures for November. And are we alone? NASA holds a conference at its headquarters in Washington to discuss a finding that will impact the search for extraterrestrial life. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
Time for some of your thoughts on the stories we've been covering. Many of you were not so eager to gobble up commentator David Frum's thoughts last week. He said we should not raise taxes for the rich because they'll just find ways to avoid paying them. John Hellinan of Stoughton, Wisconsin asks what the alternative is.
If the rich and their apologists are so sure that the tax increases for the rich are a bad idea, they need to come up with a realistic plan to reduce the government deficit and to reduce the disparity between the rich and the poor. These twin evils will inevitably destabilize our country.
Also last week, David Brancaccio visited two parts of Virginia, rich and poor, for our Economy 4.0 series. Michael Abraham lives in Blacksburg, the poor part. He says we missed the bigger story.
Ever since Lyndon Johnson declared his war on poverty, people have been coming to the Central Appalachians and talking about how poor and destitute everybody is. I think the real issue is that there are corporate and governmental policies that have kept this area poor.
And this week, retail analyst Marshall Cohen told us that one day retailers will track in-store behavior by monitoring emails and cell phone calls. Carolyn Rupp of Boulder Creek, California, says that comment made her nearly jump out of her socks.
Say what? I thought even the NSA needed a warrant to monitor my phone calls. Please tell us they're planning to get a customer's permission before eavesdropping. Not that I can imagine how they could induce a rational person to agree to such intrusion.
And finally, our interview with humorist Amy Sedaris touched some nerves, especially her crack about people with bipolar disorder. Tim Wilson of West Hollywood, California wrote, Sedaris's piece is pure mockery and hurts people like me who are struggling and at the same time seriously pursuing creative expression. Meanwhile, Amanda Craig of Mill Creek, Washington told us, wow, it's been a while since I've laughed so hard while listening to Marketplace. Thank you for embracing the dark humor found in the lighter side of life.
Let us know if we've made you laugh, cry, or want to throw your radio out the window. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says contact. Delegates from around the world are in Cancun, Mexico this week and next, talking climate change. Front and center, the industry that's the largest polluter on the planet, electricity. It accounts for 40% of U.S. carbon pollution. But power companies can't just wait around for diplomats and lawmakers to make up their minds about carbon. Old power plants need replacing, and demand for electricity keeps going up. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong has our story.
I hop in the car and drive north of the Washington Beltway in search of hot air from the real world. And it turns out that electric utility companies are placing different bets on what a clean energy future might look like. Sure, they might end up helping the planet, but that's not why you or I or power companies bet on anything. You bet because you want to make money. Stop one, a power plant in Delaware, hosting a party. The occasion? New ownership. Power company Calpine bought the plant this summer and converted it right away from burning coal to gas, which spits out about half the carbon dioxide of coal. Why the switch? Calpine CEO Jack Fusco.
Coal prices have continued to go up, and gas prices have continued to go down. If you actually look at the economics today, you would be burning gas, not coal.
Natural gas is cheap, Fusco says, and domestic and abundant, thanks to new drilling techniques. So its roughly 20% share of U.S. power generation stands to grow, whereas coal, which is almost 50%, is getting pricier thanks to demand from China. And new pollution rules coming out of Washington might make it unaffordable for many coal plants to comply.
I believe that the days of the older, smaller coal plants are really numbered for a variety of reasons. They're inefficient and they're dirty.
It's a self-serving statement for a natural gas guy. But Lena Hansen of the Rocky Mountain Institute think tank says he's right.
Across the board, the trend is to a lower carbon electricity system. And utilities are taking a lot of action towards that with their increased investments in not only gas, but also in renewables.
But gas isn't a sure thing. Energy prices are notoriously volatile, and stiff environmental rules are a possibility. Still, Hansen says gas plants are relatively cheap. It's a relatively small bet in uncertain times.
We don't know what's going to happen with climate legislation. We don't know what's happening with technology or even with demand.
Renewable energy is a different kind of energy and a different kind of bet. For that, the evidence is right up the toll road.
Prepare to enter highway on the right towards New Jersey Turnpike.
Steps away from exit 13, New Jersey workers are installing 15,000 solar panels at one of the largest solar farms in the state. They line up the units, one long row after the other. Worksite head Ed Cartledge says solar panels are tough enough to withstand heat, cold, and other stuff.
Folks have asked, what about bird droppings, things like that. I said, well, believe it or not, the good Lord takes care of that because we have a thing called rain.
Look up and you see solar panels too. New Jersey is installing them on utility poles across the state. Joe DeLuca is with the company Petra Solar, which makes the panels on utility poles. He attributes all this activity to state law. New Jersey is forcing solar power onto energy buyers.
The buyers are the utilities who have a mandate for specific amounts of renewables that they have to generate per year, which without using direct taxpayer dollars enables a good and robust deployment of renewable energy.
This is a policy bet. New Jersey is gambling on solar being a big part of the energy future and trying to get out in front. The state is now the number two generator of solar energy in the country, behind California. In all, more than 30 states have clean energy mandates. But there's a risk here, too. The states had assumed Congress would give a big boost to renewables through climate legislation, which didn't pass this summer. Ralph Izzo heads New Jersey's largest utility, PSE&G.
States now are asking themselves, my goodness, I have a 10% unemployment problem. I was happy to be a leader, but I've just charged up this hill and the troops aren't behind me. can I afford to continue this?
Solar power is still one of the most expensive ways to generate electricity.
Can we build environmentally friendly generation that can compete in the marketplace? The answer to that comes back a resounding no.
In other words, for low-carbon electricity to become a long-term winning bet and seriously displace coal, national and international policymakers may have to jump in. Michael Greenstone is an economist at MIT.
What we need to do as a planet is find cheaper sources of low-carbon energy, and we need to buckle down and begin that as soon as possible.
Either by pushing down the price of clean energy through research and development, or jacking up the price of dirty energy. The odds on that happening right now are quite uncertain. So even though the big power plants are placing their wagers, it may be a while before we have a winner. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. By Meritas, a worldwide alliance of law firms committed to helping business owners and in-house counsel find local, pre-qualified legal counsel for over 20 years. Meritas.org. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, following up on Scott's piece about electricity, the Vatican is looking for a new Pope-mobile, preferably one that runs on electricity. Pope Benedict XVI evangelizes for clean energy. The church even published a book showing what the Vatican, the building itself, has done to make itself sustainable. Apparently, the main hurdle to a new plug-in car is the Pope's security force, which expressed concerns about the ability of an electric vehicle to act as a speedy getaway car in an emergency. Not a problem, say the experts. 0 to 60 in 3 seconds flat. Pope my ride. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow packed on 2.25%, 249 points to close at 11,255. The NASDAQ jumped 2%, 51 points, ending at 2549. And the S&P 500 pocketed 2.1%, 25 points, finishing at 1206. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this broadcast, why wait for the federal government to determine a response to climate change?
Well, local governments are living laboratories, so they can try out different strategies for reducing energy use, for changing transportation patterns.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.